This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Yesterday, when the Medal of Honor ceremony at the White House kicked off, I obviously turned it on, and it's motivating, so I thought I would share it with you. For those of you who didn't get an opportunity to either listen to it or see it, give it a listen right now, and it's button-popping proud. A lot of Marines in attendance. The White House Chief of Staff, retired General John Kelly, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Dunford, Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, obviously Sergeant Major Cannon and his family are all there as he becomes the 300th recipient of the Medal of Honor that is worn in the uniform in the United States Marine Corps. So, here it is.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, accompanied by Medal of Honor recipient, Sergeant Major John L. Canley, United States Marine Corps, retired.
Let us pray. Almighty and holy God, whose spirit is unfurled to every breeze from dawn to setting sun, in the midst of this ceremony awarding the Medal of Honor to Sergeant Major John Canley, we call on your presence, Lord, as we remember those days of fierce combat in which Sergeant Major and his Navy Marine Corps combat team fought for life in the crucible of the Vietnam War. We acknowledge to each other and to you, God, that seared into the action of those days of intense and sustained fighting are the echoes of American battles long forgotten, hundreds of skirmishes and combats, and the tradition of things endured and things accomplished, even battles yet to come, such as regiments hand down forever. With great humility and high respect, Lord, we turn our hearts to Sergeant Major and the warriors who descended into the ferocity of the violence so described in this Medal of Honor citation. We are forever grateful for their sacrifices to our nation. In your providence, Lord, we pray for all our war guardians on watch today. Courage and strengthen them as they protect our country. Finally, righteous God, may this Medal of Honor testament of the fidelity and courage of Sergeant Major John Canley be a place where our nation finds unity and strength in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Amen.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And thank you very much, Chaplain. Appreciate it. Please sit down. Vice President Mike Pence, thank you for joining us for today's ceremony. This is always one of my favorite events. I like brave people. We meet them right here. 50 years ago, an American Marine fought with unmatched bravery in one of the longest and bloodiest battles of the Vietnam War, the Battle of Way City. The name of that heroic Marine is Sergeant Major John Canley. Thank you.
sitting here smiling like a dope. And that's not the normal reception you hear at the White House during one of these ceremonies. And I fucking love it.
I think you like them. Today, we proudly award John the Congressional Medal of Honor. John's family is with us to pay tribute. His children, Ricky, Yukari, and Patricia, along with his two grandchildren, Victoria and Candace. Thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it. Also with us is John's cousin, who has always been like a brother to him, James Canley. James, thank you very much. Stand up, okay? We're grateful to be joined by Deputy Secretary of Defense Patrick Shanahan. Thanks, Patrick. Secretary of the Navy Richard Spencer. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford. Hey, John, there's some pretty big people over here when you hear that, right? These are the biggest. These are the biggest, John. Former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Peter Pace. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Robert Neller. Thank you. Thank you. Stand up, Bob. Come on. Stand up. Thank you, Robert.
That's
Sergeant
awesome.
Major of the Marine Corps, Ronald Green. And
it's like a rowdy reception in the White House. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's like old family week, huh? Well, here's a Marine I like a lot that we all know, we all love. He's doing a fantastic job. Four-star General John Kelly. Stand up. And thank you as well to Congresswoman Julia Brownlee for being with us. Thank you. Thank you, Julia. Thank you very much. We are especially thankful to be joined by five previous Medal of Honor recipients. Donald Ballard, Harvey Barnum, please stand as I call your name, Roger Donlin, Thomas Kelly, and Brian Thacker.
Barney Barnum looks great.
Sergeant Major John Canley was born in Caledonia, Arkansas. In 1953, at the age of 15, John used his brother's paperwork to enlist in the United States Marines. John, we didn't know that, John. John served in South Korea and Japan before shipping out to Vietnam for more than 5 years of intense combat. On January 30th, 1968, Vietnamese families gathered to celebrate the Lunar New Year known as...
Yeah, he said 5 years. I heard that. I was like, what? 5 years? Holy shit.
Tet. In the midst of the celebration, thousands of North Vietnamese communists launched surprise attacks all over and throughout the country. This became known as the Tet Offensive, one of the largest enemy offensives that we've ever seen, and certainly of the Vietnam War. Within the first day, the communists seized control of a vital American stronghold, Way City. At the time of the attack, John was a gunnery sergeant with Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment. This company of roughly 150 Marines was tasked to help take back the city. On their way, the enemy attacked them with machine guns, mortars, rockets, and everything else they had. John's friend, Pat Fraley, was struck by a rocket explosion and was about to be run over by a tank when John charged through enemy fire and carried him back to safety. Today, 50 years later, Pat is here with us at the White House to honor the hero who saved his life. Thank you for being here, Pat. Where's Pat? Pat.
He had trouble standing, walked with a cane.
That's great, Pat. Thank you very much. I knew you'd have no problem getting up. That's great. Thank you, Pat. Early in the battle, John's commanding officer was seriously wounded. Command then fell to John, who quickly organized his men and led them through the fight. One of his fellow warriors who joins us today, John Legato, said, "You followed him because he was a true leader. He was totally fearless. He loved his Marines, and we loved him back." Where is John? Where are you, John? Stand up, John. Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you very much for being here. By the end of the day, John and his company of less than 150 Marines had successfully pushed into the city, which was held by 6,000 at least communist fighters. In the days that followed, John led his company through the fog and rain, and in house-to-house, very vicious, very hard combat. He assaulted enemy strongholds, killed enemy fighters, and with deadly accuracy did everything you had to do. He raced into heavy machine gun fire on many occasions, all to save his fellow Marines. In one harrowing engagement after another, John risked his own life to save the lives of those under his command. During the fifth day of combat, John and his company were tasked with liberating the Joan of Arc School, which had become a strategic and symbolic stronghold of the communists' control of the city. As soon as John's company arrived, communist forces unleashed their machine guns with tremendous velocity, tremendous violence, all at the Marines. Undeterred, John and his comrade, Sergeant Alfredo Gonzalez, fearlessly charged forward with rocket launchers, killing the enemy and driving them from their positions. The enemy didn't know what the hell happened. During this daring maneuver, Sergeant Gonzalez was shot and killed, giving his life for his nation and for his fellow Marines. Today we are honored to be joined by Sergeant Gonzalez's mother, who I just met, who is incredible, Maria. Where's Maria? Maria. There's Maria. Thank you, Maria. Everybody in this room had great respect for your son. You know that. Thank you very much. We're also joined by Henry Murphy, whose brother Walter died fighting courageously in the Battle of Way City. And Henry, where are you, Henry? Please stand up. To Maria and Henry, we are eternally in your debt. Sergeant Gonzalez and Major Murphy are heroes who will live forever in the hearts of all Americans. Thank you both very much for being here. Thank you. Thank you very much. As the battle raged on, Sergeant Major John Canley fought his way inside the Joan of Arc school. There he and his fellow Marines went room to room in brutal close quarters combat. John raced straight into enemy fire over and over again, saving numerous American lives and defeating a large group of communist fighters. After an intense day of fighting, John and his fellow Marines liberated the school. But John wasn't done yet. Despite sustaining serious injuries, very, very serious injuries, he continued to face down the enemy with no thought for his own safety. John waged 7 straight days of unrelenting combat, personally saving the lives of more than 20 Marines. By the battle's end, American Marines had defeated the communists and taken back the city. Today, we are joined by more than 30 of the brave Marines who fought with valor in the Battle of Way City. Would you please stand? You make us all very proud. Thank you.
It's awesome. You can see the jaws quivering.
Sergeant Major John Canley continued his service long after Vietnam, training thousands of Marines in combat drills and overseas. Now, at 80 years old, you don't look 80 years old to me. Looks like we could put him in, Joe, right away, right? Nobody would know the difference, right? It's really great. He still goes to the gym. I asked him that question. I said, how are you keeping in shape? I still work out, sir. It's beautiful. And he goes right on the base, right near his home in California, and gives advice to young Marines. John's fellow Marines have described him as a Marine warrior, and I can see it, who is bigger than life and beyond the reach of death. He is truly larger than life. John, it is because of your extraordinary personality and being and whatever it takes that really do something very special for our country. America is the greatest force for peace, justice, and freedom the world has ever known because of you and people like you. There are very few. There are very few. Brave people, but very, very few like you, John. It is now my incredible privilege to present Sergeant Major John Canley with the Congressional Medal of Honor. And I would like to ask the military aide to come forward and read the citation. Thank you.
The President of the United States.
Barney Barnum was the first one out of his seat, snapped to the position of attention. Awesome.
States, in the name of Congress, takes pleasure in awarding the Congressional Medal of Honor to Gunnery Sergeant John L. Canley, United States Marine Corps, for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty in action against the enemy, while serving as Company Gunnery Sergeant, Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, 1st Marine Division, from 31 January to 6 February 1968 in the Republic of Vietnam. Alpha Company fought off multiple vicious attacks as it rapidly moved along the highway toward Way City to relieve friendly forces that were surrounded by the enemy. Despite being wounded in these engagements, Gunnery Sergeant Canley repeatedly rushed across fire-swept terrain to carry his wounded Marines to safety. After its commanding officer was severely wounded, Gunnery Sergeant Canley took command and led the company into Way City. At Way City, caught in deadly crossfire from enemy machine gun positions, He set up a base of fire and maneuvered with a platoon in a flanking attack that eliminated several enemy positions. Retaining command of the company for 3 days, he led attacks against multiple enemy fortified positions while routinely braving enemy fire to carry wounded Marines to safety. On 4 February, he led a group of Marines into an enemy-occupied building in Way City. He moved into the open to draw fire, located the enemy, eliminated the threat, and expanded the company's hold on the building room by room. Gunnery Sergeant Canley then gained position above the enemy strong point and dropped in a large satchel charge that forced the enemy to withdraw. On 6 February, during a fierce firefight at a hospital compound, Gunnery Sergeant Canley twice scaled a wall in full view of the enemy to carry wounded Marines to safety. By his undaunted courage, selfless sacrifice, and unwavering devotion to duty, Gunnery Sergeant Canley reflected great credit upon himself and upheld the highest traditions of the Marine Corps and the United States Naval Service.
Now the president places the medal around his neck and fastens the clip in the back. John Canley standing there in uniform at 80 years old. Looks like he could serve today.
God, we give you thanks for all good things, and especially today for Sergeant Major John Canley. Grant that his devotion to his country and to his Corps may instill in us the spirit of gung-ho so that we may bring out the best in each other and also in our nation. According to thy will, O Lord. Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain in your seat until the President has departed the East Room.
Awesome. If you get a chance to watch it again, it's about 21 minutes and 38 seconds of motivating Marine Corps stuff. So it's awesome. I love the way the Marine Corps Marines get rowdy in there. That's how we should do it. And again, the 300th Medal of Honor awarded to a Marine in the history of the Marine Corps. So not an insignificant day. The other thing that I want to listen to is a question and answer period on the Middle East that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff did this week. So whenever he does these kind of things, I love to play them for everybody. Makes us all smart, me included, on what's going on. So without further ado, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who was at the ceremony, sitting front and center from I think it's Holy Cross College, and a native of Boston, Massachusetts, Joseph Dunford.
Day today, and we'll continue on through tomorrow. So I won't take any more time. I'll see if Mr. McGurk wants to just make a few comments, and then we'd be happy to take whatever questions you have.
No, thanks. Very briefly, we had a really good discussion of the counter-ISIS campaign. Counter-ISIS campaign, kind of a microcosm of this effort. We started with 14 coalition partners, and now up to 79 coalition partners. I think the theme of the day was the conventional fight is not over. It's coming to a close. We can kind of see the end point as we're in a final phase of operations in Syria. But that's not the end of the campaign. So we talked about transitioning to a new phase, really focused on the stabilization and the sustained effort. So in Syria, I think you're pretty well familiar with the effort from the coalition. about $300 million in contributions just over the last 4 to 5 months alone, which allows us to really sustain our stabilization initiatives. Even in very difficult places like Raqqa, we have 150,000 Syrians have returned to their homes, and we have Americans on the ground working with other coalition partners to do that very difficult diplomatic work on the ground day to day. In Iraq, similarly, we've now trained 170,000 members of the Iraqi security forces. We had a very good presentation today from the new NATO mission commander that will be based in Iraq to help continue to professionalize the Iraqi security forces as they look to ensure the enduring defeat of ISIS in controlling their sovereign territory. And similarly, on the stabilization civilian side, a key component of our effort in Iraq, we announced today from the State Department the continuing commitment really led by Vice President Pence, Secretary Pompeo, Administrator Green, about $178 million in U.S. foreign assistance funds for vulnerable communities in Iraq those communities so damaged by the fight and campaign and the genocidal acts by ISIS, particularly north of Mosul and the Nineveh Plain. We also in Iraq, we discussed this today, there's a new Iraqi government emerging and very encouraged by the leaders that are coming to the forefront there. A new Speaker of Parliament, Mohammed El-Boussi, a long-time friend of ours. Also a new Prime Minister designate, Adel Abdelmehdi, similarly someone we've known a long time, a real Iraqi patriot, and looking forward to getting in the chair. And a new President Barham Saleh, similarly someone we've known a long time, and we have congratulated him on his selection. Our Deputy Secretary of State just finished a very productive visit to Iraq over the last couple of days, and I'll be heading back there later in the week. So the overall focus today was on the ISIS side. We've made a lot of progress in the last 4 years, made an awful lot of progress in the last 2 years in particular. It's not over, but when the conventional fight ends, we're going to transition to this new phase, and that's really the focus on the stabilization, continued burden sharing from the coalition, and in Syria, making sure the defeat of ISIS is enduring. As we work just as hard, and Ambassador Jeffrey now in the chair leading the diplomatic effort in Geneva to try to resolve the underlying civil war, and also working to ensure the Iranians cannot continue what they're doing in Syria, because it's just leads to the cycle of violence that we've seen. So that was a very good discussion with a bit of a look back, but most importantly, a look ahead with burden sharing from coalition partners.
Just a quick comment on why Mr. McGurk's here sitting with me, and but more importantly, why we asked him to come to the conference, and he supported it all 3 years, is one of the messages, of course, is that this is the solution to violent extremism, and particularly the underlying conditions, is a whole of government solution. And there is a military dimension, and chiefs of defense play an important role in supporting in the military dimension. That's the counterterrorism fight, and in many cases deal with mass migration. But getting after the underlying conditions, the economy, the education, the legitimate governance is a broader issue. And so what we've tried to do throughout the day is make sure that we have in context the role of the chiefs of defense. One of the things that I think most of them will be more empowered to do when they return back to their countries is to describe the nature of the challenges that we face and help craft more comprehensive solutions to deal with violent extremism beyond just the military solution, which, as we know, can deal with the symptoms, but not the long-term issues. As Mr. McGurk said, as we transition to the phase, many times today, the words, it's not about winning the war, it's about winning the peace, were addressed, or thoughts like that, because it really is the work that Mr. McGurk has embarked on right now that is most important, to make sure that the success that we've had to date, and it's real and it's quantifiable, but to make sure that the success that we've had to date is enduring.
Let me just tell you, this was a meeting of the defense chiefs of 82 different nations hosted by General Dunford. So when he's talking about what defense chiefs can do and the whole of government solution, that is quintessentially Joe Dunford, and you've heard something that I talk about all the time, which is phase four, which is winning the peace. So when you have people talking about that, you know it's on the right track. You know it's on the right track. So Joe Dunford.
Thanks to both of you for doing this. On the detainees that are in Syria, that's been a lingering problem for months. The Secretary was in Europe earlier this year trying to convince allies to take responsibility for some of them. Can you give us an update on the discussions today about whether or not there's any progress in having any of the countries take responsibility for some of those detainees, and is the U.S. willing to do that also? And if not, are you coming up with any alternative?
Yeah, so I raised the issue this morning, and I'll see if Mr. McGurk has anything else he wants to say. I did raise it in my opening comments this morning. I said we have over 700 detainees with the Syrian Democratic Forces from over 40 countries. And although we have been successful in returning some, there are still many more that have to be returned. I think we all recognize that many of the individuals that led ISIS in the early days had been detainees at one time or another. And so what's very important is that we address this properly, and particularly, where appropriate, return them home for prosecution. The challenge has been there's not only political issues, but there's legitimate legal framework issues for addressing this in many of the countries. And so Secretary Pompeo, at Secretary Mattis's request, has made this a high priority for the State Department. We're appreciative of the State Department's engagement with each of the countries from which these individuals come. But it's been a long, slow progress, and again, no one in the room today was in a position to commit to do something about it. But again, part of today is raising awareness on those challenges that we have that must be addressed. So I know that the chiefs of defense will return home to their home countries and make it clear that this issue was addressed and that some action is required, particularly from the countries that these individuals came from.
As we're working, and my colleague Nathan Sales and his team's been working on this capital by capital, as we're working to try to repatriate these people to their home countries for prosecution, given the difficulty with the legal challenges and things, although we are making some progress in that, we're also making sure inside Syria that these people are housed in a facility in which they can't simply commingle with each other, so they become a kind of a nucleus for a future threat. We want to make sure that they can never get out. And that as they remain in Syria, they remain in a facility that is safe, that is secure, that has access to the ICRC, so it meets international standards as much as possible, and is also well-resourced. That's something else that the coalition, we're calling on a coalition to help with the burden sharing of this, because it truly is a multinational problem. I think we have 700 detainees from about 40 different countries. So, again, the benefit of having so many chiefs of defense here today was to raise this issue in some detail as we discuss it with the civilian counterparts in these capitals.
Saudi Arabia, given the disappearance of the Saudi journalist and his presumed killing, do you think the U.S. military relationship with Saudi Arabia is at risk? And have you considered downgrading or canceling, or do you see any impact on the military relationship given the...
Yeah, sure. Enough to look, it's a fair question, although I'm not prepared to discuss it yet. I've been here, of course, locked up all day, and I think we're waiting for Secretary Pompeo to come back, and certainly any change in our military-to-military relationship would be a policy issue. But I think it's very premature to speculate on what may happen, so I don't have any more to add on that today.
You know what? He's so good at handling that kind of stuff in terms of just the way he gives you a complete answer. You know, Secretary Pompeo's not back. You know, it is a legitimate question. I don't have the information, blah, 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 blah. And Secretary Mattis the same way. I love the way these guys operate.
To your Saudi counterpart who is here, and did you bring up the issue?
I have a bilateral meeting with him tomorrow. So yesterday I had, you know, 7 or 8 meetings and had a few through the day. So I haven't got to all the bilateral meetings that I'll have yet. I do have one with him tomorrow, and certainly I'm not going to raise anything now that I'll speak to him about. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. The question is for both of you. As you may know, tensions are very high between the U.S. administration and Iran. Are you concerned that the U.S. strategy in Syria and in Iraq, which is mainly to fight ISIS, could turn into a war or a conflict with Iran or with Iranian militias?
First, let me address the broader context. We obviously were in the region before we were dealing with violent extremism, and we have a deterrent posture, and we have national security interests in the region, maintaining freedom of navigation in the Straits of Hormuz through the Bab el-Mandab is certainly one of those. Deterring regional conflict is another, and now we're dealing with violent extremism. So our deterrent posture remains. That is the framework within which our presence in the Middle East occurs, And so we'll continue to ensure that anyone who would attack U.S. forces or attack U.S. interests understand that that we're in a position to respond.
Quick follow-up, sir. As you may know, the United States coalition has deconfliction lines with the Russians. Are you in favor of having deconfliction lines with the Iranians?
Yeah, that's going to be a policy question that, you know, to the extent that I'll talk about that, I'll talk about it in private until we change U.S. policy. But we have not had a conversation about that recently.
I would just add, in Syria, we want to see the Iranians leave Syria. You've heard Secretary Pompeo speak to this, Ambassador Bolton and others, and frankly, even the Russians tell us that's their goal. So there seems to be some consensus that the Iranian and their forces inside Syria should leave Syria. We're obviously committed to staying in Syria for the enduring defeat of ISIS, and as Secretary Pompeo has discussed, other mutually reinforcing objectives also come into play there. In Iraq, we support the sovereignty and independence of the Iraqi government and the Iraqi state, and many things the Iranians are doing in Iraq actually clearly violate Iraq's own sovereignty. On the military side, obviously, as the chairman said, we'll be prepared to protect ourselves, but nobody wants a conflict inside Iraq, and we're there to support the Iraqi government and support Iraq's own sovereignty and independence.
First, just a follow-up on Joe's question. NBC News is reporting that the administration has a new plan for Syria that involves in adding diplomatic pressure on Iran to help drive them out of Syria. Is this part of the discussion today, or is it already part of the plan to keep pressure diplomatically and economically on Iran to make it not worth their while to be in Syria?
Let me answer your question. Is it part of today? Today has not been about Iran at all. Today has been about violent extremism, and I talked about the areas in West Africa, Libya, talked East Africa, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, to some extent Southeast Asia. So the issue of Iran, which is really a U.S. With other nations specifically, is not part of this broad network of information and intelligence sharing. I wouldn't want to conflate the two issues. The countries that are here today, the 80-plus countries, are not here to talk about Iran. They're here to talk about violent extremism. So, no, it hasn't come up in any sidebar conversations, any bilateral conversations, and certainly not in a plenary session.
Secondly, one of the causes of the rise of ISIS in the first place was their use of social media, their online campaigns, the ability to recruit. Has that come up today as a topic on how do you prevent like a second wave of online recruiting or misinformation to potentially fuel another rise?
Yeah, I'll talk to how it's come up, and then Mr. McGurk may want to comment. I certainly raised in my opening comments that the media production of ISIS over the past year has been reduced to about 83%, and which is a significant progress. And their magazine, which was at one time monthly, hasn't been out in a year. So we've had some success in the media space. We've also had some success in cyberspace, without going into a lot of detail. I think, and then the other comment we made is, among the many things we need to think about as we look at violent extremism to the future, their ability to leverage technology, cyber capabilities, information operations, and for that matter, remotely piloted vehicles and other capabilities is one of the things we need to anticipate and be out in front of. And so we very much believe that dealing with the ideology is important, the narrative, if you will, and a key piece of that is going to be denying them the ability in cyberspace to have sanctuary. So much as we have worked over the last few years to deny them sanctuary in the physical space, we've done the same thing to deny them freedom of movement in cyberspace. And again, as Mr. McGurk outlined, we've had success in both areas. I don't think either one of us. We've been doing this too long to be complacent, so we're not complacent. But we do believe that the trends are all in the right direction, and we need to identify those areas where we've been successful and reinforce them, and then anticipate those challenges that we're going to see around the corner and make sure we're in a position to deal with them when they arrive. And that's a big piece of our conversation today.
Okay. couldn't quite hear you. Did you say ISIS media production has been reduced by 83%?
I did. I did. Yeah, this 2016 to 2017 is the number, and I'll confirm the 2016 to 17. But I believe that the numbers that I quoted was the reduction over a 1 year period from 2016 to 17. And Pat, I just ask you to fact check that beforehand. I know it's 83%. I'm pretty sure that's the window of time. Yes, thanks.
Awesome. And John,
started conducting independent patrols with coordination right away. And so the real issue that President Erdogan and President Trump, gave us for a task was to ensure that we provided security in that area and provided security in a way that gave confidence to Turkey that the challenges from Manbij were being addressed. And we did that immediately. And then when it came to combined patrolling, one, we needed to just develop a staff plan that included how the patrols would be conducted, how the patrols would be command and control, what the rules of engagement would be. And then we needed to get individuals to go be trained to conduct these combined patrols. Frankly, we were moving at a reasonable pace. There wasn't a sense of urgency about it. The immediate security issues were addressed right away. There was no calendar that said we must begin to conduct combined patrols by a certain date. And I would tell you, I've met with my Turkish counterpart twice in the past 3 weeks. Yesterday was the second time. And he has expressed, on both occasions, he's expressed satisfaction with the progress to date. We believe that we have now met the direction from President Erdogan and President Trump from the security perspective around Manbij, and we'll be ready soon to transition into the vetting of individuals and the political piece of Manbij. But I reframe the issue a bit and not say, hey, why did it take so long? We were given a task, and we're actually accomplishing that task. And we're reasonably satisfied in the context of all else that we're doing right now that we met the mark.
Sir, this morning you said it takes a network to feed a network. And then you spoke about Operation Gallant Phoenix and the fact that that may be expanded to West Africa and Southeast Asia. How will that work?
Sure. Jim, I'm glad you gave me a chance to clarify. We're not necessarily expanding Operation Gallant Phoenix to West Africa or Southeast Asia. There are similar initiatives in West Africa, Southeast Asia, and other areas where regional initiatives to set up a center where information and intelligence can be shared. But you bring up a good point. One of the key things that we're trying to do right now is to make sure that we have an architecture in place where these nodes can be complementary. And because, again, we're dealing with a trans-regional problem, these nodes are designed to give us visibility on the flow of foreign fighters, the flow of resources, and an appreciation for the messaging. And what we want to do is make sure that as these initiatives are stood up in other areas outside of Operation Gallant Phoenix, that they're all able to give us collectively in this network that we're talking about. When we talk about the network to defeat a network, that network is in a room down the hall here about 100 feet. That's the network that we're trying to reinforce. And we just want to make sure any initiatives to better improve regional or national intelligence information sharing also complements the trans-regional information and intelligence sharing that we think is so critical to stay out in front of the threat.
That's good, Corey.
This is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joe Dunford, and he fielded questions on Wednesday after he hosted 82 chairmen of defense chairmen from around the world. And this is mostly centered on the Middle East.
We've obviously heard a lot about ISIS in the last couple of years, but you mentioned Al-Qaeda this morning in your comments. Can you walk us a little bit through
how do you view the state of Al-Qaeda and their maybe their interconnectivity between the different groups, obviously?
Sure I can, in a couple minutes. Number one, I think it's fair to say, and you can quantify it, that Al-Qaeda's ability to conduct external attacks was disrupted quite a bit over the last few years, and they've been relatively quiet in that regard. Having said that, we don't have any illusion about what their intent is and what they are trying to do in terms of developing the capability to conduct external attacks. What we have seen is increased communications between Al-Qaeda and their affiliates in an attempt to broaden the network of individuals who can plan and conduct attacks elsewhere. We've seen linkages from Al-Qaeda in West Africa to Al-Qaeda in Syria to Al-Qaeda in South Asia. So in my judgment, they are trying to regain relevance by increasing that network and conduct attacks. We're trying to, all of what we just talked about a minute ago is an effort to stay out in front of that. In other words, this information, intelligence sharing, and a common understanding of not only the geographic location of the threat, but the character of the threat and the intent of the threat is all designed to stay out in front of that threat and disrupt these plots when they occur. I don't have the statistics offhand, but I could get those for you. When we look at, for example, Operation Gallant Phoenix and the numbers of intelligence tips that have led to law enforcement actions in disruption of attacks, most recently in Netherlands, where seven individuals were ready to conduct an attack, I think it's that kind of work that we're doing that really is designed not just for ISIS, but for Al-Qaeda and, frankly, any of these groups that have trans-regional implications. And, we're really talking about two things here. Today, we're talking primarily about this network of chiefs of defense and nations, more properly, that are trying to have a trans-regional approach to a trans-regional problem. But we also want to make sure that where appropriate, we can help local forces deal with challenges they have that could become connected to a broader trans-regional terrorist organization. And that's what we see Al-Qaeda trying to do, is leverage groups in various areas that are disaffected and try to rebrand them with an Al-Qaeda brand. And again, the key to staying ahead of that is the information intelligence network and then the action that can be taken either by the coalition in areas where we are operating or by other coalitions, as an example, the G5 in the Sahel, which has an AQIM problem. I don't know if Mr. McGurk has anything on Al-Qaeda.
We've got time for two more. We'll go to the gentleman. Patrick.
Ultimately, from ASP, can you give us a little idea of 40 countries where these things are from? How many are from, say, Western European countries which do have pretty established
Yes, I don't think we're in position to address kind of where individuals are from. We also leave it to certain countries to announce or not their efforts to bring people back. But it's about 40 countries and over 700. And as I said, as we work to try to encourage capitals to bring them back as they work through their very difficult legal processes, we're focused just as intensely inside Syria to ensure that these people are housed in a way that does not allow them to significantly commingle and that meets international standards to the extent possible. So it's a very difficult problem, but I don't think we're going to get into breakdown of numbers.
And can you say whether anyone is actually willing to set an example?
Oh, yes. Yeah, some countries have. Yeah, but we leave it to them to state. Yeah, again, not in huge numbers, but countries definitely, we have had some breakthroughs.
Sorry, we got Jeff, go ahead.
Thank you for doing this. This morning you talked about how both ISIS and Al-Qaeda have kind of changed the ways that they've operated. Conventional warfare isn't necessarily working as well. How concerned are you, especially given that we heard from during the OIR briefing this morning, that we had the arrests of the financial operatives who were in Baghdad and Erbil. In Ramadi, there were arrests. There were stockpiles uncovered in Anbar, and attacks on infrastructure in Kirkuk. Have ISIS in particular and also kind of found ways to get around and harden themselves against the current coalition strategy? And how expansive are these networks that seem to be popping off?
Sure.
Sure. I think both Mr. McGurk and I can talk about this. As a result of the success we've had over the last couple of years, the enemy has adapted. This is not a surprise. This was anticipated by the intelligence community. And frankly, the word the intel community uses is atomized. They've become much more dispersed in terms of their command and control. And so when we talk about the success we've had to date, we very quickly qualify that by saying we've had success to date in dealing with this particular manifestation of ISIS, but we're under no illusion that we're dealing with a long-term challenge when it comes to violent extremism, and they will try to adapt. The key is for us to be in a position with our intelligence and information sharing to disrupt the terrorist acts and the other acts of violence that they have conducted to try to gain our attention and maintain relevance. I believe that we still have good visibility on these networks. We are still achieving a disruptive effect. But if I've at any point today conveyed complacency, let me quickly correct that, because I'm not at all complacent. We are dealing with an enemy that now has morphed into a more decentralized threat. We still are putting great pressure on them. We're denying them freedom of movement. We're denying them sanctuary from which to plan attacks. The less terrain that they hold, the fewer resources they have, so they have resource challenges. The more success we've had, we've also eliminated some of the immediate capacity. But make no mistake about it, they're in the process of trying to regenerate all of that in a different form. And the key is for us, and that's one of the messages we talked about today, is we know from previous experience that when you relieve pressure on the threat, they will take the ability to reconstitute. And so the key to success is to continue to provide pressure, even if that pressure is a different kind of pressure, when they're not holding as much ground and they're operating in a more decentralized manner. That doesn't relieve us of the responsibility to relieve pressure. What I did say was that they'll be less susceptible to conventional military operations when they're not holding large areas like Mosul, Raqqa, Ramadi, and the other areas that have been cleared over the past year. Does that get at the question that you're asking?
A little bit. Also curious just about how, given that the news that, you know, there are cells that are activating in places that have previously been cleared by U.S. forces or U.S.-backed forces and by the U.S. Bombing campaign, how extensive are these networks? Or are you worried that ISIS, in this new diffused warped structure, has been able to set up cells in key places like Baghdad, where they can cause a lot more trouble,
okay,
and you can't reach the potential for
it? I'm going to let Mr. Hurt jump in, but I would just say this. We are not surprised that this is what they have done. They've done this in previous permutations where, you know, they have been cleared from large areas of ground and then have gone to ground and had these cells. At the end of the day, this is a fight for intelligence. That intelligence to leads to the actions that are necessary to disrupt their plans. And so we have to be a bit more deliberate in our intelligence collection, and we've got to adapt our network just as they have adapted their network, and that's really what we're doing. And I think Mr. McGurk's efforts on stabilization are also a key to that. I'll let him talk to that local law enforcement.
Yeah, I would just say we always anticipated, and I think if you heard the chairman myself over the years, we always anticipated, again, defeat of the physical space is not the defeat of ISIS. They will try to morph into clandestine networks. But it gets to a key theme of this conference, where you had ISIS in 2014, a truly global phenomenon, tens of thousands of foreign fighters coming into Syria and Iraq, planning and plotting major attacks around the world because they weren't feeling significant pressure, using these sanctuaries for that. You want to kind of get that down to what is a regional and then a more local problem. And I think the example of, I heard you say it must have been brief today, of our very close partnership with Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga in taking down the financing cell is an example of this, enabling local forces to be able to take on the problem on their own so it doesn't become a more regional and global phenomenon. It's exactly what this kind of new phase of the campaign will transition into. And so that was fairly encouraging. But we have to keep the pressure on, maintain our presence in Iraq and Syria, and also help ensure that people can return to their homes and get on with their lives. This is extremely difficult. In Iraq, we've had 4 million Iraqis have returned to their homes in areas that used to be controlled by ISIS. That's a fairly remarkable statistic. Some areas have really come back to life, like East Mosul. Others, like West Mosul are frankly going to take a decade or more to get back on their feet. And that's where working with the World Bank and other international institutions to really drive the investments that will be needed for a challenge like that is where the focus is. But in terms of ISIS morphing into a more clandestine cellular network, this is something we anticipated and working very hard on the intelligence side and with the Peshmerga and the Iraqi security forces to continue the pressure similar on the Syrian side. And that's what we mean by enduring defeat. So while the defeat of the physical space is actually, we don't want to put a timeline on it, it's very difficult in that final area in the Euphrates Valley, but that will not, the enduring defeat will be a longer-term effort. And again, that was a key theme of having so many chiefs of defense here today. That's why it's so useful to have these very important meetings, because that was a critical theme. We have to sustain this on the military side and on the civilian side.
One slide that we looked at that may touch on this as well. We looked at a slide early in our intelligence brief that showed terrorist acts from 1970 to today. And so what you see is a kind of relatively flat line of terrorist activity that really spiked in 2014, 2015. And the trend lines are now down, where the numbers of attacks and the lethality of attacks have been reduced. But the effort that must now be in place to sustain that is really what we talked about today, and we have done it in the past. But the enemy, what we do know is this: when the enemy holds ground, like they did in Iraq and Syria in 2014, they are a much more lethal threat than they are when they're running, on a constant basis, and they don't have physical sanctuary from which to plan and conduct operations. And when they aren't able to tax people and garner the resources associated with oil and so forth, that when they were holding large terrain. So in that regard, the lethality has been reduced. That doesn't mean they're not dangerous.
I just want to thank you again for being here. I appreciate it. And I have a quick question for each of you. For Brett, just building on some earlier questions today about the mission in Syria, sometimes from the outside it's hard to untangle when the post-kinetic ISIS stabilization mission will end and when something else will begin. And it seems to me like what people in the administration are now saying is that the United States will have some sort of presence, possibly military, maybe just diplomatic, until Iranian forces leave, which seems to me like would be the end of the Syrian conflict. Is that correct? And if so, how do you reconcile that with the regime's stated desire to take back the rest of the country, and what would be the authority for that? And then should I ask my question now?
You can wait.
So the military mission in Syria is ISIS. That is clearly the coalition. That's where the authorities derive from. And it's not over. So we still have a ways to go. And again, even when that final, and it's a very difficult, I think Secretary Mattis just spoke to this, this final phase of operations on the map is very small, but it's extremely, extremely difficult. And I've been to Syria. I've been there about 20 times. I've met many of these guys leading these operations, the IEDs, the snipers, the suicide bombers. So it's going to take time to finish that up. But even once that's finished, the enduring defeat, those authorities remain in place, because we all know that if you just declare defeat and leave, the problem can come back. So we feel very comfortable about the longer-term platforms in terms of our platform for an enduring defeat. And what the coalition has done, particularly by stepping up with the $300 million in stabilization assistance, we now can kind of look over the horizon, and we're pretty confident we'll be able to sustain that. Again, Secretary Pompeo has spoken very clearly about mutually reinforcing objectives in Syria. So obviously, enduring defeat of ISIS is a top priority. We have other very important priorities, trying to resolve the underlying civil war. And that's what Ambassador Jeffrey is working so hard on now, to try to get the Geneva process really reinvigorated. And we would like to see the removal of all Iranian-backed forces from Syria. And as I mentioned, that's something we hear from our partners and competitors all around the world as something that is they like to see. And, even as I mentioned, the Russians have said the same thing to us. We don't fully trust everything they tell us, but it's interesting that they say that. So, okay, well, let's see how we can do that. But the means of doing that will be different than the way that we fought ISIS, obviously. So, but they're mutually reinforcing objectives in Syria. I think our presence provides influence and provides stability. This area of northeast Syria, it's a pretty stable, permissive environment. We want to keep it that way. We're very encouraged by the work we're doing with the Turks in Manbij, which has been very constructive. So there isn't really a kind of a a set point in when the phases transition. It's more of an evolution, but we're heading now into that evolution to a more sustainability and stabilization phase. And again, we have Americans on the ground doing pretty heroic work every day to get after it.
General Dunford, just ask you a Saudi-related question. I think part of, and the reason why I'm asking that is because I think that the way a lot of people in Congress are seeing this Khashoggi situation builds on their feelings about the U.S. involvement in Yemen and the Saudi conflict in Yemen. And just because I don't think I had a chance to ask you since the certification came out, do you also believe that Yemen, that Saudi Arabia is doing enough to reduce the risk of civilian casualties?
I mean, look, we're working with the Saudis to do exactly that, to reduce casualties. But Missy, the real focus, too, is we believe Saudi Arabia and the UAE have a right to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. And much of our effort has been to help to protect them from the missile threat and the remotely piloted vehicle threat that comes from Yemen. And so we've helped support them. We do believe that our engagement has reduced civilian casualties. It's improved their tactics, techniques, and procedures, so to speak, and we believe our continued engagement, that was the point of Secretary Pompeo's letter, that our continued engagement would help us continue to move in that direction to reduce civilian casualties. It's absolutely the objective that we have. But I'm not ready to connect the two issues.
I've got two quick follow-up questions. From the foreign fighters issue, first of all, you mentioned that some nations already have taken back some of their foreign fighters. Setting aside Macedonia, can you tell us whether any of those countries have been European?
Again, I'm sorry. I just don't want to get into the specific countries because we have a pretty fixed principle, given the sensitivity of this issue, that we leave it to each capital to announce and to discuss this.
And then separately, as you sort of talked about the importance of some of these countries taking these bad guys back as appropriate for prosecution, the U.S. has been holding a U.S. audience now for over a year without bringing him home for charges. Has that been a factor in any of these discussions? And is there any update on what's the discussion of what's going to happen with this guy? Does he come back here? Do these discussions send him back to Saudi Arabia, get reinvigorated? What's going on there?
Again, I think that case, it just highlights the difficulties of this challenge. So obviously that's a case that is in our court system, so I defer the Department of Justice on that. But it highlights the difficulties of this challenge that so many of our partners are facing. A lot of these people are dangerous people. And to bring them back, you want to make sure that they can be prosecuted. And what's the evidentiary basis for that and everything, given the standards of evidence in different countries? It's a very, very difficult legal policy and procedural question. And I think that case that obviously is moving within our own court system, I won't comment on it specifically, but it just highlights the difficulties of the nature of this.
Final question.
Because that'll be everybody's had one, so that'll be and we got to run back in and close out the conference. So,
when Seth Jones at CSIS is about to come out with a report, it's been reported but not in full detail. But the top line is that they've never counted more violent extremists than right now, despite more than a decade of battling them. Do you think that's accurate?
Kim, I'd have to see the methodology. I'll be honest with you. When we started in 2014, really a concerted effort in Iraq and Syria, the estimates, as I recall, were 20 to 30,000 fighters. That about right, about, 3 or 4 years ago. And today, many of the think tanks and so forth that have published have said the number is about 20 to 30,000, which would be the same. I find that very difficult to believe. And so I would have to address your question, Ken, I'd have to see what is the methodology. What is the geographic orientation of the study? Here's what we know, so we can talk about numbers. We know that the numbers of attacks from 2016, 2017, and into 2018 have significantly reduced. We know that. We know that the lethality of those attacks
have significantly reduced. And that's not ISIS attacks. It's overall terrorist attacks. I don't think we ever knew the numbers of people that might be inclined towards radicalization back in 2014, and I'm not sure we know that number today, which is why many of the nations today are talking about efforts to ensure that individuals don't become radicalized, and those that have become radicalized, or re-educated, so to speak. But I don't have a lot of confidence in numbers that are being bounced around, and I would find it hard to believe that the numbers of individual terrorists have significantly increased at the same time the numbers of attacks and lethality of attacks has significantly decreased. Again, I'm not for a second complacent that we're not still dealing with a challenge, a large challenge, a trans-regional challenge. I accept all that, but I don't have a lot of confidence in the math, and I'm not, you know, Brett's been dealing with this as longer than anybody, and so I'd see if he has anything on that.
The fixed numbers, just the numbers are different, but the fixed data points are important. I mean, suicide bombers is one we look at. So suicide bombers, we've had years ago 70 a month or something in Iraq. Most of the suicide bombers, we believe, were foreign fighters, the ones that we could document. That number has gone significantly down to less than 5 and 6 a month sometimes now, even less than that. So it doesn't mean it can't pop up again, but that's a pretty fixed statistic for the really kind of hardcore. To get a suicide bomber into the country to the target takes a very advanced network, and we've seen that number go down significantly. But I just want to emphasize what the chairman said. We're not complacent at all. This is a massive challenge. It's a long-term challenge, and that's why this network of chiefs of defense here is so important, most importantly, protecting all of our homelands.
This is global, including Africa and Asia.
Yeah. Well, and Kim, whatever the number is, it reinforces one of the other themes that I'll close with is, we said, the first thing I said this morning is we're talking about solutions informed by the fact that it's trans-regional and it's going to be a long time. We need solutions to this problem that are politically sustainable, fiscally sustainable, and then militarily sustainable, and sustainable in the context of all of the other challenges that we have. And so, again, whatever the numbers are, we know we're in for a long-term endeavor. We've got to go back in and close out the conference, but thanks so much for being out here.
That was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on Wednesday, and you can see why he holds that position. He's as good as it gets. We'll take a quick break. Gunner joins us next here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.